Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest, or I guess I'm your guest, Chancellor Aycock. I'm visiting with you out at your home, and so you've been gracious enough to let me join you.
I'm very happy to have you with us, and we'll chat a little bit at your discretion.
Well, a lot of us who live in Chapel Hill and are sort of newcomers hear about the, I guess we talk about the old times when Chancellor Aycock, well, when Dean Aycock was running the law school, or when Chancellor Aycock was running the campus at Chapel Hill, when President Friday was running the greater university or the system or the big university. And it's hard for us to put ourselves back in those times.
Well, thank you. I really wasn't dean of the law school. I was acting dean when Dean Henry Brandis went off to teach at Stanford for a year. But other than that, I was a member of the faculty of the law school for many years. But I did have a little turn at chancellorship, and we'll talk about that later.
Well, another thing that always interested me is your coming back from World War II back to Chapel Hill, and the friendship that developed among a group of people that included, of course, yourself and President Friday, Governor Sanford, I believe maybe John Jordan, Bill Dees, and other people who became prominent
with
it. And Dixon Phillips.
Yeah. Oh, yes. They were all but one of those that you mentioned were in my law class. We all got out of the service. But Terry Sanford was 1 year ahead of us, and of course, he grew up in Laurinburg, the hometown of Dick Phillips. So we were with him, but the five of us, and there's a picture on the wall of us five right now, and all four of the five are still living. Bill Dees grew up in Goldsboro, but we are all still very close. You know, the Friday, Jordan and Phillips and me, us four, we get together quite often to this day. We were all in the class of 1948.
What was, you served in World War II. Talk about how you happened to get into the Army, what you did before the war, and then what happened afterwards.
Well, I am a graduate of NC State, and NC State had an Army ROTC. The first 2 years at that time, the state that had become the land-grant college, the first 2 years were mandatory. The last 2 years is something that you elected to do, and they had to decide to select you, and the juniors and seniors were the ones that helped train the incoming freshmen and sophomores every year. But when you got through and you went to summer camp, it happened to be at Fort McClellan, Alabama, then you became a lieutenant when you got to be 21 years old. So I had a reserve commission. And so when the bomb was dropped in Pearl Harbor, it was just a matter of them cranking out my name on the IBM cards at the Pentagon. And so I was gone in January. That started.
This was the Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, and by January of 1942, you were in the service?
Yes. In 42, I was. I'd already gotten my orders, and I was on the way to Fort McClellan, Alabama. And I stayed in the Army for 4 years. until after they dropped another bomb in Japan, and that put an end to my service in the Army. So I drove.
Well, now I'm going to interrupt you just a minute because I apologize for doing this, but I'm real curious about you World War II veterans. You're reluctant to talk about what you did, but tell us a little bit about your service, because you entered as a second lieutenant, but you had some scrambled eggs on your cap when you left.
Well, I actually entered the active service because I'd been a second lieutenant. I had been promoted to first lieutenant before I actually reported for active duty in Fort McClellan, Alabama, in January 1942. That's correct. And it so happened, and I won't go into all the detail, the officers at Fort McClellan, that was an infantry resident training center. We trained mostly draftees, for the various divisions that were formed or being formed. They were replacement troops. And we had, for as old with, we had 31 or 2 battalions at a time at Fort McClellan. And so the officers were supposed to rotate out too. But believe it or not, various circumstances of which I did not control, they kept me there 3 years. But after the bulge started, then I was ordered directly with other, at that time, lieutenant colonels, a whole plane load to get over to Europe and join up with some ongoing units. And I joined the 87th Infantry Division over in Belgium, and then stayed with as a battalion commander until we went all the way till Germany surrendered, and we were all close to Czechoslovakia. Then the decision was that divisions like the 87th would be sent to the Pacific, and those who had been over there a while in the 87th had been down in the Tsar and other places before they were sent up to Belgium. We were to leave all of our equipment, everything, and come back to get outfitted in the United States and on the way. Those 5 race divisions went directly with their equipment to the Pacific. The 5 divisions that we were a member of were to be re-equipped and sent. And the older division, like the 30th National Guard Division, which had been in service even before the war started, they were kept in Europe in occupation for a period of time. So that was my only experience in active duty. It was almost a year. We got back over here in late summer, and then when they dropped the bomb in Hiroshima and the end of the war, then we were fit to be released at that time. And so I had always wanted to go to law school. That would have been, it was my original intention, to go to law school. So I drove up from Camp Shelby, this Mississippi, which was the separation center, all night long, and got to Chapel Hill on the way to Raleigh. My wife at this time was in Raleigh, and Dean Weddup was the dean of the law school. And so I registered. They had school on Saturday at that time, and got law school 2 weeks after it started. And that's where I met I already knew Bill Friday, but I met Judge Phillips, and I knew Bill Dees when he was an undergraduate because we were in student government together. I was a graduate of the state, and he was a graduate here as an undergraduate. And John Jordan I met for the first time. And so...
All of you all enrolling post-World War II into the UNC Law School.
That is correct. We were in the same class. Some of us got there in the fall semester, and Bill Friday, I believe, got out of the service a little late, but he enrolled in January. But we all went to summer school, so we all were in the class, graduated in the class of 48.
We're visiting with former Chancellor Bill Aycock, and we'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with former University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Chancellor Bill Aycock. And Chancellor Aycock, thanks for letting me come visit you in your home.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, and I keep up with all the good work you're doing. And I won't forget that my grandson was permitted to drive you around on one of your excursions over the state.
Well, we may not have time to talk about your family, but your son is was a contemporary of mine in the practice of law, and then I had the privilege of learning from him and admiring him, and then to be driven around the state by your grandson and namesake was just a great treat. He's such a wonderful, wonderful young man. I guess that it's kind of all of this sort of friendships that develop along the line. The friendships that I'm so curious about, you were beginning to talk about with your friendship with Bill Friday, with Bill Dees, who became chairman of the Board of Governors of the UN, of the big university, and John Jordan. You brought Dixon Phillips in as became a dean of the law school, a federal judge. These were turned out to be people that are widely admired for their prominence, prominent leadership roles, but also, by and large, just a real sort of commitment to public service. And did that develop out of the war? Did it develop out of the conversations y'all had in law school, or was it just something you can't explain?
No, I think the war was just another event. I should mention that John Jordan was the third chairman of the Board of Trustees. Bill Dees had gotten interested in education. I made a speech about him down in Goldsboro. He'd been on the local board, and he had worked his way up on the Board of Higher Education. And I was tempted to say to him, they were honoring him, that in my opinion, that he had given more to education for nothing than a lot of us had given for pay. In other words, they were always interested. And John Jordan, you know, ran and was elected to the Senate, and he was very interested in education. Dick Phillips, he started practicing in Fayetteville with Terry Sanford from his boyhood friendship. But we got a chance to invite him up here to join the faculty, which he did. And then he became the dean, and he became a federal judge. But he every one of them was just inclined to do something for education. And they did. And do.
Well, after you graduated, you didn't, or I'm putting words in your mouth, but it's my understanding that you pretty quickly got, that the faculty wanted you to join them at the law school.
Yes, in my second year, Herbert Bayer, Professor Herbert Bayer, lost his voice completely. And I was an older member of the class, 4 or 5 years older than most of them. And Herbert Bayer knew that I had done some public school teaching in Greensboro, North Carolina. And so he wrote me a note and asked me, would I be willing to carry on the class while he was trying to get his voice back? And I said I'd do the best I could. And he was always well prepared and had beautiful notes and sat up there with him, and I carried on the class, but they were cooperative. They understood, including the ones I'm talking about, for 6 weeks. And when the 6 weeks was up, Henry Brandis had bought him a microphone and the treatment. He'd gotten better, and I sat down the class and finished it.
Well, so you were taking the class that you taught. Is that?
I was in. And a little bit later, Dean Witter called me in and said that the university had granted a assistant professorship, a new one, for the law school, and the faculty had assembled and instructed him to invite me to join the faculty. And I said, well, Dean Willing, I certainly would like to, but I don't graduate till next year. He says, well, we'll hold the job for you. I says, I'll take it. And so that solved it. So I graduated in December because I'd been to summer school. And so in January, I started teaching. And, of course, all my students were my classmates.
Well, you were teaching then. You could take the bar early back then. Had you taken the bar, or did you ever take the bar? What was the deal?
Well, we took the bar in March at that time. They gave it March and again in the summer because of the veterans. No, we all took the bar together. So I had to leave the class and told them, I said, well, I got to go and take the bar and try to remove the cloud on my title.
What courses were you teaching at this time?
Well, I started out teaching federal courts and also one of the property classes. They had different courses of real property and personal property. They put them together later at that time. They were my early courses, yes.
A lot of people remember your courses, or at least my contemporaries who were in law school after you'd come back after being the chancellor to teach, and they talk about wills and estates. And was that one of your favorite courses?
Wills was one of the courses at that time. So I later took that on, and I later got into antitrust and unfair trade practices. And I also taught a course, and they needed some more people to replace the Judge Advocate General's Corps. Well, I had started working with Judge General's Corps after I started teaching. And I started teaching courses in military law. And they had the Uniform Code of Military Justice that came out. And this was, of course, much broader than that. But it included that. So I taught that here and as a visitor up in Virginia. So that was one of the courses that I generated from the beginning.
Along the way, you took a year or so off, or a few months off, to accompany former university president Frank Porter Graham on a mission to resolve the problem of Kashmir between India and Pakistan. Do you remember much about that experience?
Oh, yes, I remember very vividly, and I went with him as his personal assistant, and it was, we went to up to Kashmir, had two trips up there, and we from back and forth from India, we were in Old Delhi to Karachi, then the capital of West Pakistan, five different times. we had a plane, a UN plane that was made available to the mission, and the mission included General Devers, a military advisor, who was acquainted to Frank Graham because at one time he had been head of Fort Bragg, and he was a four-star general and retired, a wonderful person. And then they had about seven from the UN staff. The lawyer on there was Miguel Marine, M-R-A-R-I-N, Marine, who had been a young lawyer with the League of Nations, and he was Spanish, and in charge of the mission was a fellow from Holland, an older fellow from Holland, and we had some secretaries from England, and there were about 13 of us, and we learned a lot. I made 40 speeches about Dr. Graham's role in that particular mission around the state. Anybody that asked me, I'd go and do it. But it takes me a little.
Well, it's relevant, I guess, in those of us who keep up with world affairs. This dispute, which you all worked on, and has frustrated diplomats and people all across the world for now 50, 60 years. It just seems insoluble.
Yes, that didn't surprise us. The real hope was that Dr. Frank Graham would appeal to the both sides, and he would be their foot in the door. There wasn't anybody had any hope in that mission that they would have a plebiscite and let them vote, because a majority were Muslims. But the owner of the territory was Indians, and so if either side had given in any substantial way, whatever government they were represented, they'd be gone the next election, and we all knew that. But a lot of people forget that Dr. Frank Graham was trusted by the representatives from both state, both countries, and he stayed at the UN available to either side for the same period of time he was president of the university, for 19 years. So he served a purpose to keep them from fighting. Since then, they've done a little scrapping, but not an all-out war, because they're both a nuclear powers at the present time.
Well, while you were on this UN-sponsored mission in India and Pakistan with former President Graham, you all must have talked from time to time about the university and about North Carolina and about this tradition of service. And what do you remember about him and about those conversations, as they might have had an impact on your service?
Well, he was so wrapped up, and it was a tough. It was tough for him to even get an audience with Nehru, who was the head of India at that time. He spent 10 days writing a letter to Nehru and reading the history of India and so forth. But he was successful at that, and he eventually invited all of us to his home for outdoor party, so to speak. But to tell you the truth, I don't even remember, since we were so tied up with the challenge of that particular. What we wanted to do, of course, was to get demilitarization of the troops from Indian Pakistan out of Kashmir. And that took a lot of figuring and doing and
working. That problem was so pronounced that the opportunity to visit about things back home was not there. Well, listen, we're visiting with former Chancellor Bill Aycock, and he and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bill Aycock, the former Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the now Professor Emeritus of Law at the University of North Carolina Law School. And Bill Aycock, a lot of us look back on the late 1950s and the early 1960s when you were Chancellor as the formative time, some of the toughest times that folks at the university face. And looking back at it, looks pretty good. But will you tell us about how you were persuaded to leave your happy life as a law teacher and jump in the in what became a cauldron, I guess, in the chancellor's office? Or did you know what you were getting into?
I knew precisely what I was getting into. The Board of Trustees, when I first started teaching, Watts Hill being the leader, encouraged me to do a study and make a recommendation about the governments of the new Health Affairs Division, which was a tremendous growth from the med school going from 2 years to 4 years, for a new dental school and for a new nursing school with advanced people to train leaders in the nursing field, and add to that the School of Public Health and the School of Pharmacy, and the new hospital. That caused a lot of concern as to just how it works. So he wanted me to write a code, and I said, I can't do it. I don't know enough. But he finally convinced me to make a study and see how it worked. And so Grace and I was teaching, spent all our spare time, she helping me, studying the whole Health Affairs Division from the beginning to the end, and did make some recommendations, which is written up, and I presented to them. I say this to let you know that I knew what was going on there. And I knew a little something about athletics because at NC State, I was president of the student body and ex officio, a member of the athletic council. And so I got to know a little about Hunk Anderson and all their troubles with him and that sort of stuff. And of course, Bill Friday was my classmate, and when he asked me to serve, I said, well, I'm primarily a teacher of law, and that's what I intend to do, but I will join and take a turn and help out. And so I agreed not to continue on, but at an appropriate time, I thought it was time to get back to teaching. I had taught in the law school 9 years before I became chancellor, and when I went back after 7 years as chancellor, which has turned out to be about the length of time that people usually serve in that job, then I went back to teach 21 years until mandatory retirement. So I did both, and I would do it again under the same circumstances.
Well, we don't have a lot of time, but there were a number of I tell you what, let's take a break and then come back, and then maybe I won't have to interrupt you again. But I'm visiting with former Chancellor Bill Aycock. We're talking about his career at Chapel Hill and living in Chapel Hill. And we'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bill Aycock, and we've learned quite a bit about some of his early career. And let me just put it this way. When Holden Thorpe was made chancellor recently, he said, I'm not a young chancellor. He said, Bill Aycock was a young chancellor.
Yes, he told me that when I went to hear him in Girard Hall. Paul Harden has been good to me, taking me because I can't drive. And so as soon as he got through, he had already been installed down at the system building down the road. But the trustees had him to talk to local people all together in Girard Hall. So when he got through, he walked over to me and said, somebody said that I was the youngest chancellor. And said, somebody interrupted and said, no, he's not. He said, it's Bill Aycock. Now, I guess that was true, but I never thought of it as being anything that would have anything to do with me being chancellor. But I just happened to be younger.
Well, there was this generation of folks who came out of World War II who, for various reasons, had served at pretty high levels during the war, who had a quiet confidence that they didn't think of themselves as young anymore. President Friday was one of those. And when he called on you to serve, I guess you didn't think of it as anything other than being natural. Let me put this question to you, because we don't have a lot of time to talk, but looking back at those times, you look at the dilemmas or the challenges that faced you. One was racial unrest and racial integration, the search for what the right way to handle that would be. The other was this speaker ban law that developed, that the General Assembly passed, and that many years later, we still look at that as a real crisis point in the university. It turned out to be an opportunity to make a real statement. There was a beginning of student unrest. And then there was the relationship between the campus and the UNC system that was in flux and in challenge and was a tough assignment for President Friday and for the chancellors. Don't forget the challenge of the athletic problem that developed as a result of learning that some of the athletes might have been participating in point shaving or in something like that that required firm action. As you look back on it, which of those was the hardest challenge for you?
Well, I think the speaker ban was the most dangerous, and it took up most of my time. I couldn't imagine claiming to be a university and having people's mouths shut, even by the legislature. So I consider that the thing that must be attended to. A lot of us got involved over a period of time with the race problem. And athletics it needed some attention because of that. About every 10 years, this point shaving business arose up. And of course, that took some time, and we worked on that. But the speaker ban was absolutely imperative that we do something about that. And it was done, and I have a letter here from the lawyer in that case, which they won unanimously by the Court of Appeals, and there was no appeal from the state about that particular matter. but
it in the speaker ban victory, or the resolution of that matter, probably more than any other, has been a clear-cut victory, a solid monument that the university universities here in North Carolina can say we dealt with that, and now we have a more or less a collective understanding that we're going to honor that freedom of thought and freedom of speech on the campuses.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I can't conceive of any university claiming to be one, especially the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, when anybody, whether it's the legislature or a faculty member or students, forbids someone to make a speech. And I'm not talking about the Smith Act, where you come and try to get the government overthrown and all that. That's another matter. That's a nationwide matter. But you can't be a university and have somebody deciding who can speak and who can't speak. And I think we're all clear on that now.
Well, maybe the on the university campus, the speaker ban law was maybe central. Among the public, the extraordinary action that the universities took with respect to basketball and football, the Dix Classic, and the shaving back of the schedule, the easing out of Frank McGuire, those kinds of things probably got more attention. And do you feel that the victory that was won in terms of putting athletics in a proper perspective, an appropriate perspective in the university, has that victory been solid?
Well, I think so. When I look at the athletes we have here now, I'm very pleased with them. I think they're good citizens, best I can tell.
What about on race? You and I grew up in a different era and in a different situation, and led by good people who had ideas that wouldn't be acceptable today. And we look at with extraordinary progress, but also lots of things to do. Could you have imagined back in those days of the late 1950s and early 1960s that we would have reached a level of racial harmony that we have, and more equality, so much more equality than we had? Would have this surprised you then?
Well, slightly. As you know, the first black law students in the law school came about as a result of a lawsuit, a separate but equal. The idea, Henry Brandis, who was our dean, went over and testified, there is no such thing as separate and equal. He says, there's no way. Irrespective of how good the legislature is to North Carolina Central, that's where the students were from that wanted to transfer, it'll make a difference how much library you give them, how many faculty members you give them, and I think any other resources. You can't be equal as long as you're separate. And of course, when Brown against Board came, then you knew that there was going to be a lot of difficulty in enforcing it. But it has come. If we say that's the reason that we have a president of the United States that we now have. No, I had not. I'm like most people. I just had not thought that far ahead. But I'm very glad that we are continuing to make that kind of progress.
Well, you've been away from the chancellorship for a long time and went back to the law school and served well. And I know that just from visiting with President Friday that you've continued to provide great advice and wisdom. And also, I don't know how to say this, but I think that the thing that I hear most is encouragement to people who are serving. They come back and see Bill Aycock, and they're not only inspired by your example, but also by your a pat on the back that you're always giving, always willing to give to people who are helping. So thanks very much for taking time to visit with us today.
Well, it's very kind of you to come, and I'm afraid you exaggerate my importance. I am not able to do things that I used to do. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm not either, and all of us aren't either, but we're just glad to live in the same community as Chancellor Aycock, and I want to thank him for visiting with us, and thank all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.